Welcome to Daily Wisdom, Walking the Path with the Buddha, a podcast shared by David Roylance. This podcast is dedicated to guiding you to completely eliminate the discontent mind and the suffering it causes by attaining enlightenment. Learn and practice the teachings of Gautama Buddha that will guide you to fully attain a peaceful, calm, serene, and content mind with joy. To support this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha or visit buddhadailywisdom.com, where you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online learning resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Now, here's our teacher to share more.
Sawadikap, hello and welcome to Daily Wisdom, Walking the Path with the Buddha. Today is our Pali Canon and English study group, and we're studying the words of the Buddha in this book series titled The Words of the Buddha, The Path to Enlightenment, Revealing the Hidden. We're in volume 11, which is titled The Realms of Existence. We're going to be studying chapters 81 through 90 today, and we're studying the heavenly realm because this particular book, it goes through all the five realms that the Buddha taught: the hell realm, the animal realm, the afflicted spirit realm, the human realm, and the heavenly realm. And we've been studying the heavenly realm now because the Buddha is helping you to understand this particular realm and what is experienced in this realm. These teachings are teachings that you will typically address after you've been studying and developing your practice for about a year and a half, 2 years. If you're learning for the first time with me, this isn't typically where you will start, but it does help you to learn the realms of existence, and you can independently verify that they're true. The reason why this helps you is that as you're removing the pollution out of your mind, getting closer and closer to enlightenment, where the mind's starting to experience the peace and the joy, that pollution, as you're eliminating it, oftentimes you can observe your past lives, or you might start experiencing communication with beings that are in these other realms, or you might even see some of these beings, like hell beings, afflicted spirits, and heavenly beings. Some people can actually see them. Well, if you didn't understand these cycle of rebirth and these realms of existence, you might think you're going crazy or going insane when you see these things. So remember, the Buddha isn't teaching the way the world should be, and if everybody follows certain rules or commandments, then the world will become a peaceful place. Instead, he's explaining to you the way the world is. And by understanding the way the world is, your mind awakens to these natural laws. And by awakening to these natural laws of existence, then you'll be able to navigate the world more readily. Because if you live in a world that you don't understand, you'll struggle and you'll have difficulties. So by understanding the teachings of the Buddha, you're not believing his teachings and then hoping something good happens when you die. Instead, you're learning teachings, you're investigating them and examining. You're reflecting on them to independently verify them, and then you're practicing them in order to transform the mind, uprooting these pollutions and moving closer and closer to this peaceful and calm mental state that is enlightenment. There's multiple benefits with attaining enlightenment. Not only is the mind peaceful, calm, serene, and content with joy, but you also experience focus, concentration, clarity of mind, and deep memory. You'll notice your personal, professional relationships will blossom. You won't even be in a bad mood anymore. By the time you get to enlightenment, you're always in a good mood. So I'd like to welcome all of you to our class today and invite you to read the chapters that we have. I have 10 chapters that we're going to be studying, and also invite you to ask any questions that you might like to ask during our class. You can ask questions through Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom by putting those into the comment section. Or if you're in Zoom, you can raise your hand electronically and ask any questions or follow-up questions directly. So here, I'll go ahead and read, and as we go through, then I'll share some teachings on that, and then I'll open up to any questions that you guys have. Here, this chapter 81 is titled, Where Heavenly Beings Take Up Lodging. Ananda, who is building a fortress at Patalagama? Fortunate one, Sunidha in Vasakara, the Mahagahan ministers are building a fortress against the Vajans. Ananda, just as if they had taken counsel with the 33 gods, Sunidha in Vasakara are building a fortress at Patalagama. I have seen with my divine eye, or third eye, how thousands of heavenly beings were taking up lodging there. And in the parts where powerful heavenly beings settled, they caused the minds of the most powerful royal officials to pick those sites for their dwellings, and where middle and lower rank heavenly beings settled, so too they caused the minds of royal officials of corresponding grade to pick those sites for their dwellings. Ananda, as far as the Indo-Aryan people, land extends, as far as its trade extends, this will be the chief city, Pataliputra, scattering its seeds far and wide. In Pataliputra will face three dangers, from fire, from water, and from internal conflict. Okay, so this particular discourse here, the Buddha is talking to Ananda, which is one of his close students. Ananda is considered to be either his brother-in-law or his cousin. This is what we think based on the historical records. And he was with the Buddha as a student throughout his entire teaching career, essentially from the very beginning, the entire 45 years that the Buddha taught from the age of 35 to 80. And he's talking to Ananda here, and you'll see Ananda show up in a lot of the discourses because Ananda's the one who had the most profound memory to be able to remember exactly what the discourses were and wrote them down after the death of the Buddha, along with other enlightened beings. Ananda documented what it was that the Buddha taught. So here, the Buddha talking to Ananda, he's essentially explaining how heavenly beings can influence the mind of human beings. You might notice this with not only heavenly beings, but with afflicted spirits and with hell beings as well. Just like a human being can influence you through the things that they say, the things that they do, same thing can happen with hell beings, afflicted spirits, and heavenly beings as well. The hell beings and afflicted spirits, they're tending to try to encourage you to do unwise and unwholesome things that are going to lead to calamity in your life, where the beings in the heavenly realm, they're looking to influence you to do positive or wise or wholesome things that are going to produce wholesome results in your life. Ultimately, it's your decision of what you do, but these beings can try to influence you. And here the Buddha is talking about that. That's one of the things that the heavenly beings do, is they try to influence you to do wise things, but ultimately it's your decision. So by you cultivating wisdom about what's wise and unwise, no matter what being is trying to influence you, no matter what realm, whether it's hell, afflicted spirits, or heavenly realm, or even in the human realm, if there's beings that are trying to influence you, if you know what's wise and unwise, you can make a wise decision that's going to produce wholesome results in your life. Nobody can influence you if you know what's wise or unwise, and then you make the wise decision that is going to produce wholesome results in your life. Because by continuing to make unwise decisions, it's going to produce unwholesome results. So here, this particular teaching is helping you to clue into that and understand that aspect of the heavenly realm. So let me know what questions you guys have. You can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere, so I'm going to move on to the next chapter, which is chapter 82. These books, they're available at buddhadailywisdom.com. You can download them for free. You can take them and go print them. You can get printed copies here at the temple in Chiang Mai by just reimbursing us for our printing costs, essentially, or you can get them on Amazon. And what you have is you have the words of the Buddha, which you can learn, reflect on, and practice. Then you also have a reference that takes you back to the original source teachings in the Pali Canon. And then you have words from me to help you reflect on this and implement it into your practice in a way that you're going to experience beneficial results. So here I will read chapter 82 to help you guys to understand what the Buddha is teaching here about the heavenly realm. Here, this one is titled, Seven Vows for Achieving the Status of Ruler of the Heavenly Beings. Monks. In the past, when Sakka, ruler of the heavenly beings, was a human being, he was a Brahmin, youth, named Magga. Therefore, he is called Maghava. Monks, in the past, when Sakka, ruler of the heavenly beings, was a human being, he gave gifts in city after city. Therefore, he is called Purundada, the urban donor. Monks, in the past, when Sakka, ruler of the heavenly beings, was a human being, he gave gifts considerately. Therefore, he is called Sakka. Monks, in the past, when Sakka, ruler of the heavenly beings, was a human, he gave a rest house. Therefore, he is called Vasava. monks, Sakka, ruler of the heavenly beings, thinks of a thousand matters in a moment. Therefore, he is called Sahasaka, thousand-eyed. Monks, Sakka's wife is the Asara maiden named Suja. Therefore, he is called Sujamapita, Suja's husband. Monks, Sakka, ruler of the heavenly beings, exercises supreme sovereignty and rulership over the Tavasata Sima heavenly beings. Therefore, he is called ruler of the heavenly beings. Monks, in the past, when Sakka, ruler of the heavenly beings, was a human being, he adopted and undertook seven vows, by the undertaking of which he achieved the status of Sakka. What were the seven vows? 1. As long as I live, may I support my parents. 2. As long as I live, may I respect the family elders. 3. As long as I live, may I speak gently. 4. As long as I live, may I not speak argumentatively. 5. As long as I live, may I reside at home with a mind free of the stain of selfishness, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in letting go, devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. 6. As long as I live, may I speak the truth. 7. As long as I live, may I be free from anger, and if anger should arise in me, may I eliminate it or cut it off. Okay, so here the Buddha is talking about this rebirth of Sakka, ruler of the heavenly beings. During the lifetime of the Buddha, there was a certain cosmology that existed during his lifetime. What I mean by cosmology is the way they looked at these realms, how they described these realms, how they thought of these different realms. Nowadays, when we think about hell, animal realm, afflicted spirits, human realm, and heavenly realm, we just think of them as one particular realm. But during the lifetime of the Buddha, he segmented the hell realm into multiple categories. And he also did the same thing with the heavenly realm, that he broke it up into multiple categories. Just like in the animal realm, there's different species, and in the human realm, there's different ethnic groups. In the heavenly realm and in the hell realm, there's different categorizations of beings in the realm. And you don't need to know the cosmology that existed during the lifetime of the Buddha in order to get to enlightenment. Understanding the five realms and some of the details that I teach you about these five realms is enough. But here he's talking about this being Sakka, ruler of the heavenly beings, that rules over all these different beings and all these different categories of heavenly beings. And he's talking about this being having been a human being in the past and the different things that they did in order to acquire this status of ruler of the heavenly beings. The ultimate goal of the path to enlightenment isn't to get to the heavenly realm. The ultimate goal is to get to enlightenment in this life so that you can escape the cycle of rebirth and escape the discontentedness. But because of this ruler of the heavenly beings that the Buddha is describing, he's explaining certain qualities that led to this rebirth for them in this heavenly realm. And the way that you can take a discourse like this is that the same things that lead to rebirth in the heavenly realm are the same exact things that lead to enlightenment. So you can extrapolate certain lessons that the Buddha is teaching that is helping you to understand this cause and effect or action and result of what leads to rebirth in the heavenly realm. That's what the Buddha is teaching you in this discourse, is how do beings get reborn into the heavenly realm? But that's not the ultimate goal. The goal is to get to enlightenment. So you can extrapolate what he's sharing with you here in order to help you to understand what it would take to actually get to enlightenment. So in this first section, all these different things that he's talking about, he's actually talking about generosity and how this being, in order to become the ruler of the heavenly beings, practiced a significant amount of generosity in their life as a human being. But then he goes on and he explains these certain vows or this certain practice that this individual developed. And here you can extrapolate this and you can choose to practice these same things, because these same things that lead to rebirth in the heavenly realm also lead to enlightenment as well. So I wouldn't suggest that anybody aspire to be reborn in the heavenly realm, but instead extrapolate the lessons here so that you can actually use those as wisdom to be able to train your mind and actually get to the enlightened mental state. So here, the first one he's talking about, may I support my parents? The Buddha talks in other discourses about your parents, and he talks about them as being your original teachers. Because without your original teachers, without your parents, you wouldn't have been able to come into this world, because they're the ones who were able to bring you into the world. But then they also helped you to sustain your life. When you first came into this world, you weren't able to sustain your life. If somebody would have left you in the middle of a field, you would have died in that field because you didn't have the ability to sustain your own life. So no matter what you think about your parents, and I'm sure you did not agree with everything that they did during your life, the Buddha talks about this debt of gratitude, essentially, in different teachings, where at least they supported you, they brought you up, they showed you the world. And in some cases, parents did a whole lot more than that. But if you have resentfulness or animosity in your mind that you're holding on to related to your upbringing, your parents, you're going to need to let that go and no longer hold on to that in your mind. And maybe what you can do is you can think about how you can have this gratitude just for the fact that your parents clothed you, they fed you, perhaps you went to school, and other things like this, that they helped you to sustain your life. And now that you're an adult, you're able to make wise decisions for yourself. But if it wasn't for those original teachers, you wouldn't have learned things like washing your body or brushing your teeth or learning how to comb your hair. And if it wasn't your biological parents, nowadays there's foster parents, there's adoptive parents, there's grandparents that fulfill that role, there's aunts and uncles and other people like that. So the Buddha teaches to have respect not only for your elders, but also your parents and other people like this all throughout your life. Sometimes what you're taught in some cultures is don't respect others until they respect you first. Well, if everybody practiced this, nobody would be respecting anybody because everybody would be holding back their respect and they wouldn't be respecting anybody until everybody else respects you first. Well, if everybody's holding back their respect and waiting for someone to respect you, then nobody's respecting anybody. So that's very unwise. That's that cultural conditioning that the mind holds on to, which is very unwise. And there's lots of these kinds of things in various cultures. Instead, you need to break through that and realize that it's wise for you to respect all beings. Here, the Buddha's talking about supporting parents and respecting the family elders because this is wise, but it's also wise to respect everybody in the world because whatever you put out is going to come back to you. So if you put out respect to people around you, this is what's going to come back to you. But if you're disrespectful or you're holding back your respect and you won't respect other people until they respect you first, then nobody's going to be respecting you because you're not respecting anybody. You're going to need to break through that. Then the third one that the Buddha talks about here is gentle speech. He talks about this in the Eightfold Path and in other places as well. This is your tone, your tempo, and your word choice. That when you speak harsh and aggressive and hostile and bitter, this is almost like an animal, where an animal is growling and roaring at another animal because they don't like what they did, and they're trying to fear them into doing what they want you to do. Well, the unenlightened human mind functions very much like an animal oftentimes, but what you're doing on this path to enlightenment, among other things, is you're becoming a better and better human being. You're arising this wisdom, you're cultivating your mind, and you're becoming a better and better human being, no longer functioning like an animal. So as a human being, you can choose to speak gently to others through your tone, your tempo, and your word choice. You're going to need to train your mind through meditation and other things like this to eliminate your cravings, desires, attachments, so that you will be able to speak gently in all situations. By the time you get to enlightenment, there's no relationship where you have bitterness and hostility and animosity or anything like this. You're able to speak calm and gently to everybody and anybody in your life. So you're going to need to work on that and dial that in. And I would guide you to the Eightfold Path, where I share right speech based on the words of the Buddha and also the teaching that connects into it, which is the five factors of well-spoken speech. This is really going to help you to understand the wisdom behind the natural law of karma, of cause and effect, so that you can speak in ways that is wise and that is wholesome, so that then you can experience wholesome results coming back to you. Because as long as you're hostile and bitter and harsh to others, that's what's going to come back to you. And this is the same thing too with speaking argumentatively. It's very unwise to argue with anybody. You might have grown up in a family where there's lots of arguments, or you might have been growing up around people where they are arguing and fighting. A human being can almost fight to death, just like an animal. An animal will fight to death oftentimes. And this is what an unenlightened human being can do sometimes. It's like fighting to prove a point or to prove that you're right and other people are wrong. Arguing doesn't accomplish anything whatsoever except getting more argument. If you argue with others, people are going to argue with you. So if people pick up the rubber ball of arguing and they throw it around the room, and that's got anger and hatred and ill will and frustration, agitation laced in there, and then you pick it up and you throw it around, and they pick it up and you throw it around, and they throw it around, you throw it around. Next thing you know, you got all these rubber balls bouncing around. There's nothing but arguments, hostility, and bitterness all over the room. Well, you can choose to do something different. You don't need to continue to sit there and argue, but it's going to be challenging when you have craving, anger, and this ignorance or unknowing of true reality in your mind. You're going to need to train your mind through meditation and through practicing things like generosity and loving kindness to turn away and have enough respect and enough appreciation for this particular relationship that you're not interested in damaging it. Even though somebody else might be trying to argue with you, if you walk away, more and more when you do that, they learn. Every time they try to argue with you, you walk away, they're going to slowly but surely stop arguing because you're not feeding this fire. So you can train your mind to no longer be argumentative, and this will really help you in all your relationships. Then the fifth one that the Buddha is talking about here is generosity, that this is how you're going to eliminate your cravings, desires, attachments. You need breathing mindfulness meditation, but you also need to live open-handedly. You need to be willing to give and share your time, effort, energy, and resources. This is what's going to help you to train your mind to let go. Because when you have craving, desire, attachment, which is the cause of discontentedness in your mind, you'll tend to hold on very tightly to things, and you'll be very selfish perhaps, or even moderately selfish. So you need to be able to be willing to live open-handedly, being freely generous and eliminating this stain of selfishness. That's going to help you to train your mind to let go and no longer hold on to things so tightly. Then, of course, it's very wise to speak the truth, being a true speaker, being dependable, one that somebody can rely on. If you're lying in your personal, professional relationships, people are going to discover those lies, and they're going to consider you to be untrustworthy. And now you're going to have difficulties in your relationships, particularly in your professional relationships. People aren't going to be comfortable to give you projects and opportunities to grow and develop. So you're going to find that your income is going to struggle due to telling lies. But also, if you've lied to any certain extent, which we all did as children growing up, you got to keep your lies straight between one person and another, and that's very hard to do, to keep your lies straight. So if your mind is having to obsessively figure out what you said to one person versus another, you would never be able to get to this peaceful and joyful mental state. So by speaking the truth, you can just always look inward, speak the truth, speak what you know, and then you don't need to worry about what you said to one person versus another. And you can be loyal and dependable, and people will trust you, and then your personal and professional relationships can really grow. And then this last one that the Buddha is talking about is eliminating anger. And there's other versions of this, like hatred and ill will and frustration, agitation, annoyance, and things like this. You can eliminate this through loving kindness meditation. That's a technique that you're going to need in order to train the mind to uproot this anger and then start practicing loving kindness through your intentions, your speech, and your actions. If you walk around with anger and hostility, this is going to really weigh on you. You'll see it in your face. You'll see it in your demeanor. It'll weigh heavy on your shoulders, and it'll start to cause not only mental issues, and you'll become unskillful through your intention, speech, and actions, but it can cause physical issues too when you're carrying around all that anger. So this path to enlightenment is to purify the mind of these pollutions so that you can eliminate these types of things. And you can practice in the way that the Buddha is describing here. And this can further help guide you on the path to enlightenment. Let me know what questions you guys have here. This is chapter 82. You can put those into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom. Or in Zoom, you can raise your hand electronically and ask any questions that you like. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So I'm going to move on to chapter 83. This one is titled Offering for the Heavenly Beings. The perfectly enlightened one gave thanks thus to Sanuta and Vasakara, the chief ministers of Magaha. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce any of these names. In these verses, after he had finished eating his meal, in whatever realm the wise man makes his home, he should feed the virtuous leaders of the holy life. Whatever heavenly beings there are who report this offering, they will pay respect and honor for this. They tremble for him as a mother for her son, and he for whom heavenly beings tremble is always happy. Okay, so here the Buddha is talking about making offerings to individuals who are sharing the teachings of the Buddha. He's talking about sharing food and sharing offerings that will actually help these individuals to be able to continue to share their teachings. Because anybody who's cultivated wisdom to either get to enlightenment or very close to it, that's one of the biggest benefits of having somebody like that in the community, is that they can share the teachings with others. And typically what people do who are sharing the teachings is they give up all their worldly pursuits, that they don't go towards a career or making money or profit. You can have those things and still get to enlightenment as well. But oftentimes people who are sharing the teachings to help others get to enlightenment have given up all those worldly pursuits. And as a result, they need to sustain their life in some way. So the Buddha is advising individuals to make offerings to these beings who are sharing the teachings, because this is going to allow them to sustain their life and then be able to share the teachings with others to get to this peaceful, calm, serene, and content mind with joy, where you can experience the enlightened mental state. So let me know what questions you guys have here, if any at all. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions here. So I'm going to move on to chapter 84. This one is titled The Supreme Honor and Respect. Ananda, prepare me a bed between these two sala trees with my head to the north. I am sleepy and would like to lie down. Ananda, these sala trees have burst forth into an abundance of untimely blossoms, which fell upon the Tathagata's body, sprinkling it and covering it in homage or respect. Divine coral tree flowers fell from the sky. Divine sandalwood powder fell from the sky, sprinkling and covering the Tathagata's body in homage or respect. Divine music and song from the sky in homage and respect to the Tathagata. Never before has the Tathagata been so honored, respected, appreciated, admired, and adored. And yet, Ananda, whatever male or female ordained practitioner, male or female household practitioner resides practicing the teachings properly and perfectly fulfills the way of the teachings, he or she honors the Tathagata, has deep respect and appreciates him, and pays him the supreme homage or respect. Therefore, Ananda, we will reside practicing the teachings properly and perfectly fulfill the way of the teachings. This must be your goal and objective. Okay, this is essentially a bit of a miracle that has occurred in the presence of the Buddha. That here the Buddha is asking one of his close students to make him a bed so that he can lie down and sleep. And then these trees, they burst out with these blossoms. And then there's all these other things that are happening in the environment. And this is honoring and respecting the Buddha. And the Buddha turns it into a teaching, right? He doesn't like have this ego or this arrogance where he's like, yeah, look at me, look at this great thing that's just happened because of me. Instead, he's now turning it into a teaching to help you understand the best way to respect a teacher. Here, this is an enormous amount of respect that is being given to the Buddha, perhaps by the heavenly beings, perhaps by God that is performing this kind of thing. But nonetheless, the Buddha doesn't get all engrossed in it in terms of an ego or arrogance, because enlightened being has eliminated their ego and their arrogance. Instead, he says, okay, if anybody would like to respect me, then they can practice the teachings that I share. That's the way to respect a Buddha, is to share or to practice his teachings, because that's what's going to lead to your enlightenment. And that is acknowledging the amount of time and effort that it takes to be able to share these teachings with others, that if you're learning from a teacher, one of the very best things you could do is practice their teachings. Even if it's like a math teacher or a science teacher or something like this, if you're learning with that individual, then you choose to practice what it is that they're teaching you. That's the best way to respect any teacher, including a Buddha or somebody who's sharing the teachings that lead to enlightenment. If you're just learning and then you're not doing the real work to transform your mind with meditation and practicing all the other steps of the Eightfold Path, that's not really respecting that person's time and effort very closely. So the Buddha is encouraging students that if they would really like to respect him, to practice his teachings. And that's the most supreme respect that you could ever give to a Buddha or to a teacher of these teachings. Let me know what questions you guys have on this chapter. This is chapter 84, The Supreme Honor and Respect. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions here. Here, this is chapter 85. It's titled The Path to the Company of Brahma. So during the lifetime of the Buddha, they referred to God as Brahma. So here you're going to learn about the Brahma Viharas a bit, which I teach in the foundational programs to be able to help you to understand this. This word Brahma means God. Vihara means dwelling. So this is something that was being taught by the Brahmin, the Hindu priest, because they felt that if you practice these qualities, this would help you to reside with God after death. But the Buddha also knew that these were certain mental qualities that you need to practice in order to get to enlightenment as well. So he teaches to cultivate these four Brahma Viharas, which you're going to see here as loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. After I read this, I'll explain to you what each one of these things are. So here, this is the words of the Buddha. What student is the path to the company of Brahma, or God? Here, a monk resides, cultivating one quarter of the mind filled with loving kindness, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he resides filling the all-encompassing world with a mind filled with loving kindness, tremendous, distinguished, measureless, without hostility, and without ill will. When the liberation of mind by loving kindness is developed in this way, no limiting action remains there, none persists there. Just as a vigorous trumpeter could make himself heard without difficulty in the four quarters, so too, when the liberation of mind by loving kindness is developed in this way, no limiting action remains there, none persists there. This is the path to the company of Brahma, or God. A monk resides cultivating one quarter with a mind filled with compassion, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere, into all as to himself. He resides filling the all-encompassing world with a mind filled with compassion, tremendous, distinguished, measureless, without hostility and without ill will. When the liberation of mind by compassion is developed in this way, no limiting action remains there, none persists there. Just as a vigorous trumpeter could make himself heard without difficulty in the four quarters, so too, when the liberation of mind by compassion is developed in this way, no limiting action remains there, none persists. This is the path to the company of Brahma, or God. So the Buddha explains the same thing for the other Brahma Viharas. Here, he's talking about sympathetic joy. You can see that here. It's the exact same speech, the same exact teaching. And then this last one is with equanimity. So it's exactly the same thing that he's sharing. He's just replacing the word equanimity with all of these. So loving kindness is a genuine interest in seeing all beings be well. This is active goodwill in the mind. And you're going to need to cultivate this through meditation and then practice it through your intention, speech, and actions as the Buddha describes on the Eightfold Path. This is going to help you eliminate anger, hatred, ill will, and all the lesser versions like frustration, irritation, annoyance, even the slightest dislike for another being. You'll eliminate even the slightest dislike for other beings by the time you get to enlightenment. You won't even dislike another being. Your mind won't have those cravings and that judgment of others. You will like all beings. You can see the beauty in all beings, and it's loving kindness and cultivating this in meditation and practicing it in daily life that will actually allow you to accomplish that. So you can eliminate and eradicate this. You can even eradicate negative self-talk, because if you have anger, hatred, and ill will towards others, you might be directing that towards yourself too, where you're diminishing yourself and you're degrading yourself. So you might have this inner dialogue where you're degrading and diminishing and talking down to yourself, judging yourself. If you're doing this kind of thing, then you can transform that through the teachings of the Buddha, and you can have a mind that's uplifted rather than directing that judgment and that degrading speech towards yourself. And it's loving kindness that's going to help you to be able to do that. The next one that he's talking about is compassion. This is concern for the misfortune of others. This oftentimes comes right along with loving kindness, that as you're cultivating loving kindness and meditation, compassion kind of comes along with it, where instead of being indifferent towards others' suffering or misfortunes, that you have this concern for their misfortune. You're not interested in having craving, desire, attachment, where you're worried or having anxiety about other people's suffering or misfortunes, but you're also not interested in being indifferent either. So you'd like to bring it to the middle with compassion, where you can have this concern for the misfortune of others. Then there's this sympathetic joy. What sympathetic joy is the joy for others' success, even if you did not contribute to it. So this is the opposite of envy or jealousy. So this will help transform your mind away from those aspects. Whereas if somebody in your office has some wonderful thing that happens, maybe they get a new house, a new car, maybe they're going on a holiday, maybe they're getting promoted, maybe your friends or your neighbors are having some beneficial, so some fortunate thing that's happening in their life based on their decisions. Rather than being jealous or envious, the Buddha teaches to have sympathetic joy, where you can have joy for the other person's success. This is going to transform your mind away from envy and jealousy. Then there's equanimity. Equanimity is calmness and composure, evenness of temper, even in difficult situations. This is going to help you to keep the mind calm and relaxed rather than shaken up in difficult situations. So if you get a phone call that your mom's been in a terrible car accident and she's in an ambulance on the way to a hospital, if you allowed your mind to get shaken up in that situation, you might grab your car keys, run out the door, run to the hospital. Maybe on the way you get in a car accident yourself and get injured. Or at the very least, you're going to show up to the hospital and find it very difficult to talk to the doctors and nurses to make wise decisions that's going to help your mother. So by practicing equanimity in all situations, no matter what's going on, then you'll be able to stay calm and composed, and you'll be able to access your wisdom. Because when your mind is uncalm, you're not going to have mindfulness or awareness of mind. You're not going to have concentration or focus or clarity of mind. So therefore, you're not going to be able to access your wisdom. And now you're going to make unwise decisions that produce unwholesome results. Well, on this path to enlightenment, you're looking to get to wise decision making that produces wholesome results in your life. So by maintaining your calmness and composure with this equanimity, then you can access your mindfulness or your awareness of mind. And then you can have concentration or focus or clarity. And now you can access wisdom. So by keeping your mind calm and calmly making your way to the hospital, because you know your mom's in the best hands she could be in, she's in the back of an ambulance with trained emergency medical technicians. And she's about to arrive to a hospital with all kinds of equipment and doctors that can help her. There's nothing that you're going to help by racing across town. It's not going to help anything. So you would like to remain calm and composed so that when you arrive to the hospital, that then you can talk to the doctors in a way that's actually going to help your mother. And now when you talk to the doctors and nurses, you can make wise decisions because your mind's calm, you have mindfulness, concentration, and you can access your wisdom. There's another part of equanimity as well, because the root word here is equal. That's what you're trying to do, is you're trying to have your mind to be equal, where it's not going up and down and up and down, but it's calm and steady and stable. But that root word of equal, it also refers to treating all beings equally. You're going to need to be able to do this in order to get to enlightenment. Whereas if you do one thing for one being, you're going to need to do things for others. Let's just say you work in an office with six people and you go out to buy some bagels for your coworker. If you bought bagels for just one of your coworkers and you brought it back and you gave it to that one coworker, when the other co-workers find out, because of their attachment, because of their lack of wisdom, because of their mind having craving, anger, and ignorance, they can easily get jealous or easily get envious. And now, when they're experiencing those painful feelings, they're going to attribute it to you, and they're going to start bad-mouthing you, perhaps. So what you would like to do is, if you're doing something like that, where you're purchasing bagels for a coworker, is buy enough for everybody in the office. If that's what you are able to do, do that for everybody. If you do it for just one person, you're going to find yourself in difficult relationships where people are envious and jealous, and they don't even realize what their mind's doing. But if you understand the natural law of existence, then you understand that people's minds are polluted, and you're going to be navigating this world of unenlightened beings. And it's not wise for you to bring back bagels for just one worker. It's wise to bring it back for all your coworkers and share. Or if you're in a household and you have multiple children, it's wise to treat all your children equally and fairly. So wherever you can, you should be looking to treat people fairly. If you can't afford to bring back bagels for all six coworkers, then don't bring bagels back even for one. It's unwise to do that. Instead, wait until you have enough funds and you can bring it back for all six. Or if you can't treat all of your children equally the same way, then don't treat just one of them a particular way, because now this is going to create envy and hostility and jealousy in your household. And you would like to keep all that stuff out of there. So this is how you do it, is by practicing this other aspect of equanimity where you treat all beings equally. So let me know what questions you guys have here on the Brahma Viharas. You can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom. Or in Zoom, you can raise your hand and ask any questions that you like. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere, so I'm going to move on to the next one. This is chapter 86, and let me just see how long of a chapter we got. Okay, we've got about 2 pages here. Okay, I'll read this for you guys, and then I'll teach it to you. So here, this is titled, The Difference Between the Instructed Noble Disciple and Uninstructed Worldling. Let me first explain to you what this is. An instructed noble disciple is someone who's learning very closely with the Buddha, and that they've deeply understood the teachings and they're practicing them really well. They might not yet be enlightened, but they're on the way to enlightenment and they're practicing the teachings really well. An uninstructed worldling is someone who's not on the path to enlightenment, that they haven't cultivated wisdom of the path to enlightenment, and they're holding on to the world. So I would refer to this as a practitioner and a non-practitioner. But you should never look at it as a us versus them. You should never look down on people who aren't practicing the teachings. But the Buddha is just going to talk about some differences and disparities between these individuals. Instructed, noble disciple, someone who's practicing the teachings closely, and someone who hasn't learned his teachings at all. They're an uninstructed worldling. Monks. There are these four kinds of persons found existing in the world. What for? One. Here, monks, distant from sense desires, distant from unwholesome mental states, enters and resides in the first jhana, which is with thinking and pondering, based in seclusion, filled with excitement and joy. He enjoys it, motivated towards it, and finds satisfaction in it. If he is firm in it, focused on it, often resides in it, and has not lost it when he dies, he is reborn in companionship with the heavenly beings of Brahma's company, or God's company. The lifespan of the heavenly beings of Brahma's company is an eon, which this is an indescribable, immeasurable amount of time. The worldling remains there all his life, and when he has completed the entire lifespan of those heavenly beings, he goes to hell, to the animal realm, or to the realm of afflicted spirits. But the perfectly enlightened one's disciple remains there all his life, and when he has completed the entire lifespan of those heavenly beings, he attains final nibbana, or enlightenment, in that very same state of existence. This is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling, that is, when there is future destination and rebirth. 2. Again, some person, with the subsiding of thinking and pondering, by gaining inner tranquility and oneness of mind, he enters and resides in the second jhana, which is without thinking and pondering, based in concentration, filled with excitement and joy. He enjoys it, motivated towards it, and finds satisfaction in it. If he is firm in it, focused on it, often resides in it, and has not lost it when he dies, he is reborn in companionship with the heavenly beings of streaming radiance. The lifespan of the heavenly beings of streaming radiance is 2 eons. The worldling remains there all his life, and when he has completed the entire lifespan of those heavenly beings, he goes to hell, to the animal realm, or to the realm of afflicted spirits. But the perfectly enlightened one's disciple remains there all his life, and when he has completed the entire lifespan of those heavenly beings, he attains final nibbana, final enlightenment, in that very same state of existence. This is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling, that is, when there is future destination and rebirth. 3. Again, some person with the fading away of excitement, remaining imperturbable, unable to be upset or excited, calm, serene, mindful and clearly aware, he experiences in himself the joy of which the noble ones say, peaceful is he who resides with equanimity and mindfulness. He enters the third jhana. He enjoys it, motivated towards it, and finds satisfaction in it. If he is firm in it, focused on it, often resides in it, and has not lost it when he dies, he is reborn in the companionship with the heavenly beings of refulgent glory. The lifespan of the heavenly beings of refulgent glory is 4 eons. The worldling remains there all his life, and when he has completed the entire lifespan of those heavenly beings, he goes to hell, to the animal realm, or to the realm of afflicted spirits. But the perfectly enlightened one's disciple remains there all his life, and when he has completed the entire lifespan of those heavenly beings, he attains final nibbana, final enlightenment, in that very same state of existence. This is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling, that is, when there is future destination and rebirth. 4. Again, some person having given up pleasure and pain, and with the fading away of former gladness and sadness, he enters and resides in the fourth jhana, which is beyond pleasure and pain, and purified by equanimity and mindfulness. He enjoys it, motivated towards it, and finds satisfaction in it. If he is firm in it, focused on it, often resides in it, and has not lost it when he dies, he is reborn in companionship with the heavenly beings of great fruit. The lifespan of the heavenly beings of great fruit is 500 eons. The worldling remains there all his life, and when he has completed the entire lifespan of those heavenly beings, he goes to hell, to the animal realm, or to the realm of afflicted spirits. But the perfectly enlightened one's disciple remains there all his life, and when he has completed the entire lifespan of those heavenly beings, he attains final nibbana, final enlightenment, in that very same state of existence. This is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling, that is, when there is future destination and rebirth. These monks are the 4 kinds of people found existing in the world. Okay, so let me help you understand this one. The Buddha has other teachings where he talks about the 4 types of persons that exist in the world. Here he's not saying these are the only 4 types. He actually just is describing these 4 individuals. There's other discourses where he describes other aspects of certain persons, and he uses the same thing where he talks about the 4 kinds of persons. Here, what he's talking about in this first one is he's talking about someone who enters into the first jhana. The jhanas are preliminary phases that the mind goes through before it experiences the first stage of enlightenment. And then there's 4 stages of enlightenment by the time the mind actually gets to enlightenment, when it's actually enlightened, it's the fourth stage. And that's where all discontentedness is eliminated. There's no more anger, sadness, frustration, irritation, annoyance, guilt, shame, fear, boredom, loneliness, shyness, resentment, jealousy, even the slightest displeasure is eliminated from the enlightened mind. But on your way to enlightenment, you're going to move through these jhanas, and these are preliminary phases that you'll experience. And the Buddha describes them in his other teachings. On the Eightfold Path, you can see where he describes the jhanas under right concentration. And when you see what he describes and you're experiencing those things, you can independently verify that it's actually true that your mind does move through these jhanas. So what he's describing is someone who studies his teachings very closely and experiences these jhanas, that if they're a uninstructed worldling, they'll go to the heavenly realm having not learned the teachings of the Buddha. But then they're going to be reborn into the lower realms of hell, animal, or afflicted spirit after they exhaust their life in the heavenly realm. But a individual who's learned the teachings of the Buddha and experiencing these jhanas, and that's what they would be experiencing, the uninstructed worldling is not going to be able to experience those jhanas. But the instructed, the noble disciple, will be experiencing these jhanas. And now when they're reborn in the heavenly realm, they're going to attain enlightenment from that actual realm, and they'll no longer be reborn anywhere in the world. And the Buddha describes the same exact thing for the second jhana here. That's the second part. And then he explains the same thing for the third jhana. And then he explains the same thing for the fourth jhana, that the uninstructed worldling is going to be reborn into the heavenly realm and then be reborn into hell, animal realm, or afflicted spirits. But the instructed noble disciple, when they're reborn into the heavenly realm, then they can attain enlightenment from there. The ultimate goal would be to not be reborn anywhere. The jhanas, while they're quite wonderful, the goal is to get to enlightenment in this life. Don't allow the mind to get bogged down and get complacent there. But if you should happen to die in the jhanas, the Buddha is describing what would actually occur. So you can see the difference here between somebody who has learned and developed their mind versus someone who hasn't. But the ultimate goal is to get to enlightenment in this life so you're not reborn anywhere at all. That would be the ultimate goal. So let me know what questions you guys have on this chapter. You can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So I'm going to move on to chapter 87. Let's see. So we got about a page and a quarter here. So this one is titled Rebirth of One Reflecting on Impermanence. Monks, there are these four kinds of persons found existing in the world. Okay, so here's another four, right? What four? One, here, monks, distant from sense desires, distant from unwholesome mental states, enters and resides in the first jhana, which is with thinking and pondering, based in seclusion, filled with excitement and joy. He contemplates whatever objects there related to form, feeling, perception, volitional formations or choices and decisions, in consciousness, as impermanent, as discontentedness, as a disease, as a boil, as a dart, as misery, as affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as empty, as non-self. With the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in the companionship with the heavenly beings of the pure abodes. This is a rebirth not shared with worldlings. 2. Again, some person, with the subsiding of thinking and pondering, by gaining inner tranquility and oneness of mind, he enters and resides in the second jhana, which is without thinking and pondering, based in concentration, filled with excitement and joy. He contemplates whatever objects there related to form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, which is choices and decisions, and consciousness as impermanent, as discontentedness, as a disease, as a boil, as a dart, as misery, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as empty, as non-self. With the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in companionship with the heavenly beings of the pure abodes. This is a rebirth not shared with worldlings. So the Buddha goes through the third jhana and the fourth jhana here in exactly the same way. So let me explain to you what he's actually describing. So he's saying, okay, if somebody enters into the first jhana And now they would have had to practice the Eightfold Path very closely to get into that first jhana. He's saying, okay, whatever this person thinks about related to form, feelings, perceptions, and consciousness, this is referred to as the five aggregates. This is what describes a living being. You have physical form, you have feelings, you have perceptions, which are views and opinions about the world, you have volitional formations, which are choices and decisions, and you have a consciousness, which is a mind. He's saying, whenever you think about these five aggregates, having entered into this first jhana, that you will know that they are impermanent, meaning they're constantly changing, to not cling to them, to not hold on to them. Because you'll know that if you cling or you hold on to them, that it's going to produce discontentedness, that you see these things as being undesirable, essentially, is what he's describing with a disease, a boil, a dart, misery, affliction, alien, disintegrating, empty. And then ultimately he says non-self, that that's not who you are. You are not these five aggregates. So he's reinforcing the three universal truths here and saying, okay, someone who's entered into the first jhana would understand the three universal truths as it relates to these five aggregates. And he says the same thing about the second jhana, the third jhana, and the fourth jhana. And he says, okay, if this individual is reborn, they're going to be reborn into the heavenly realm. And this is not a rebirth that is shared by worldlings, meaning someone who's not having the wisdom of the path to enlightenment, because they wouldn't understand the universal truth of impermanence, discontentedness, and non-self, because they haven't studied the teaching, so their mind hasn't awakened to those universal truths. So let me know what questions you guys have here on this chapter. This is chapter 87 of volume 1. All right, I'm not seeing any questions here. So I'm going to move on to chapter 88. I think there's a pretty long one somewhere. Let's see, this one's not too long. It's probably going to be a repetitive chapter just like the others. This one's titled, The Future Destination of the Instructed Noble Disciple Filled with the Brahma Viharas versus the Uninstructed Worldlings. So you probably understand what this is already, that the Buddha is going to talk about rebirth of people who have trained in his teachings and their mind has all four of the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, versus someone who hasn't studied the teachings. Monks, there are these four kinds of persons found existing in the world. What four? One, here, monks, some person resides cultivating one quarter with a mind filled with loving kindness. Likewise, the second quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter. Thus, above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he resides filling the entire world with a mind filled with loving kindness, tremendous, distinguished, measureless, without hostility, and without ill will. He enjoys it, motivated towards it, and finds satisfaction in it. If he is firm in it, focused on it, often resides in it, and has not lost it when he dies, he is reborn in the companionship with the heavenly beings of Brahma's or God's company. The lifespan of the heavenly beings of Brahma's company is an eon. The worldling remains there all his life, and when he has completed the entire lifespan of those heavenly beings, he goes to hell, to the animal realm, or to the realm of afflicted spirits. But the perfectly enlightened one's disciple remains there all his life. And when he has completed the entire lifespan of those heavenly beings, he attains final nibbana, final enlightenment, in that very same state of existence. This is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling, that is, when there is future destination and rebirth. So he's going to say the exact same thing related to all of these other Brahma Viharas, which is compassion. He goes through all the exact same stuff, essentially a different aspect of the heavenly realm and a different length of time in terms of the rebirth, but it's the same thing essentially. And then he says the same thing with sympathetic joy. And then he says the same thing about equanimity. So basically what he's saying here is when you cultivate these four Brahma Viharas, it leads to this improved rebirth of being in the heavenly realm. And some people see that as improved rebirth. Some people don't necessarily see it that way, because you're very likely to be reborn down into the lower realms. But what the Buddha is describing here is that if you're practicing his teachings, then there's the ability for you to attain final enlightenment from that particular realm. So let me know what questions you guys have here. You can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or in Zoom, and I'll help you. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions. I think these chapters are pretty straightforward this week. Don't seem like we have any questions coming in. Okay, this is 89. Rebirth of a person cultivating the Brahmaviharas and reflecting on impermanence. So now you're going to combine these two, right? So here we can actually look at this without even reading it and can see what the Buddha is describing. He's talking about these four kinds of people, and he's saying, okay, someone's cultivated loving kindness and they've cultivated the understanding of impermanence, discontentedness, and non-self as it relates to the five aggregates. And he's saying, okay, this individual will be reborn into the heavenly realm. And then he does the same thing for compassion, the same thing for sympathetic joy, and the same thing for equanimity, that these people have cultivated those four Brahmaviharas and the three universal truths, that they understand impermanence, discontentedness, and non-self. And this is an improved rebirth for them by being reborn into the heavenly realm, if you see it that way. I see the heavenly realm as not an improved rebirth, because while you have the opportunity to get to enlightenment there, oftentimes those beings are complacent and they don't practice. So they can easily be reborn down into the lower realms. The ultimate goal would be to get to enlightenment in this life so that you're not reborn anywhere at all. Okay, so let me know if you guys have any questions on this chapter. I didn't think so, because you didn't have questions on the other chapters. So let's go to the very last chapter for today, which is chapter 90. This one is titled The Distinction Between the Instructed Noble Disciple with Formless Attainments and the Uninstructed Worldling. So right now, before I even describe this chapter or read it, a little bit of it for you guys, I can explain to you that what the Buddha is going to teach is he's going to share these other attainments. There's the four jhanas, which we call attainments, and then there's the four stages of enlightenment, which are also attainments. But there's these other attainments as well that some people will experience and some people won't. And I describe these attainments in another chapter, that if you go to Volume 7, Chapter 13, that's where the Buddha describes these attainments, and I describe them as well, so that you can understand what these attainments are. But here in this particular chapter, the Buddha is just going to describe the difference between someone who's realized these attainments and somebody who's an uninstructed worldling. Monks, there are these three kinds of persons found existing in the world. What three? One, here, monks, with the complete overcoming of the perceptions of forms, with the passing away of perceptions of sensory impingement, with the non-attention to perceptions of diversity, perceiving space is infinite, some person enters and resides in the base of infinite space. So that's the attainment. And the Buddha is describing what you need to do in order to get to that attainment. He enjoys it, motivated towards it, and finds satisfaction in it. If he is firm in it, focused on it, often resides in it, and has not lost it when he dies, he is reborn in companionship with the heavenly beings of the base of infinite space. The lifespan of heavenly beings of the base of infinite space is 20,000 eons. The worldling remains there all his life. And when he has completed the entire lifespan of those heavenly beings, he goes to hell, to the animal realm, or to the realm of afflicted spirits. But the perfectly enlightened one's disciple remains there all his life. And when he has completed the entire lifespan of those heavenly beings, he attains final nibbana, or final enlightenment, in that very same state of existence. This is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling. That is, when there is future destination and rebirth. So here the Buddha is describing the same thing for this other attainment, which is called infinity of consciousness. All the exact same stuff except a different part of the heavenly realm for a different length of time. And then the same thing here when someone attains the base of nothingness. And remember, these attainments are described in another chapter. So here, the Buddha, through these various discourses that we've been studying here, he's helping you to understand the difference between a being who's developed their mind and trained their mind versus somebody who hasn't, and what their rebirth is going to look like. He doesn't do this as a way to incentivize you to learn his teachings. He doesn't do this to hold a carrot or guilt, shame, or fear you into learning anything. He's just explaining the natural law of karma. He's explaining to you cause and effect, or action and result. Remember, a Buddha's mind is already peaceful, calm, serene, and content with joy. They don't want anything. They're not longing, yearning. They're not trying to pressure or force people into doing anything. The Buddha's just explaining to you the way the world is and what truly is happening, how these natural laws function. And then your mind can gradually awaken to that and learn that if you like. I encourage people to focus on getting to enlightenment, which is to eliminate the 10 fetters, uprooting those pollutions of the mind. And it's the core central teachings of the Three Universal Truths, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, Five Precepts, meditation training, and other things like this that is going to help you to be able to accomplish that. But here, if you've learned the foundational teachings and you're developing your life practice, the Buddha is explaining to you what the results of your decisions may be depending on if you get to enlightenment in this life or not. If you fall short of enlightenment for any reason, there's the potential to be reborn back into the human realm or into the heavenly realm. But if you fall really short, if you haven't been doing any work, then you'll see that there's the potential to be reborn into hell or animal realm or afflicted spirits. None of these realms are permanent existences. The beings will ultimately be reborn in and out of these realms with opportunities to get to the human realm and or the heavenly realm to be able to then get to enlightenment. But now you're in the human realm. This is the absolute best existence you could ever have. It's the ideal existence because you can now train your mind to get to enlightenment and you have built-in motivation to accomplish that. So as you would like to learn and practice and develop your mind on the path to enlightenment, you can take any of our programs, whether it's our group learning program or Polycanon and English study group. On Monday, I have a course titled Harmony in Relationships that's going to be starting here in Chiang Mai. And you can attend online or you can attend here in Chiang Mai, where you can learn how to develop harmony in your relationships. Because by the time you get to enlightenment, there's no relationship that you don't have harmony in. All of your relationships are harmonious by the time you get to enlightenment. But you'll need to learn how to do that and how to train your mind and cultivate your mind to be able to accomplish that. So let me know if you guys have any questions on this particular chapter, or anything we've been discussing today, or anything related to your journey to enlightenment. I can open up to any and all questions that you guys might have. You can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any and all questions that you like. All right, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So what I'm going to do is just end class by thanking all of you for joining for today's class. Thank you for deciding that you would like to learn and understand the teachings of the Buddha, because as you're learning and developing your mind, it's the very best thing you could do for yourself, for those close to you, and all of humanity. Because you're becoming more and more wise, you're reducing the harm that you're causing, you're making more and more wise decisions that are producing wholesome results in the world. So it's the best thing you could do for yourself and for all other beings in the world, because you're causing less and less harm. Tomorrow in the group learning program, we're going to be in chapter 23, which is titled Symbolism of the Teachings, Reminders Through Imagery. Here I'm going to be helping you to understand some of the symbolism that you'll see in artworks and temples and the architecture and different things that you'll see in the Buddhist community. And this is to help remind you of the teachings. So now that people have studied the teachings with me to a certain degree, you can learn the symbolism that the Buddha used during his lifetime and that's still in use today to help you remember the teachings. This will help you commit the teachings to your memory more readily so that then you can actually practice them and get the actual results of the teachings. Then on Wednesday, I'm going to be doing meditation, guiding you guys in meditation, and then opening up to any and all questions that you guys might have. So thank you all for joining. Perhaps I'll see you guys in a future class. Have a very wonderful and lovely rest of your day. We'll see you next time. Sawadee krap.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To provide support for this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha. To access more teachings, visit buddhadailywisdom.com. There, you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Remember to establish a daily, consistent meditation practice, along with learning and practicing these teachings. A well-developed meditation practice is the foundation in which to train the mind to attain enlightenment.